This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 15th of February, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. In Washington, anti-war groups say the debate on the war in Iraq in the House doesn't go far enough. President Bush quietly signs an executive order to authorize the establishment of military commissions. And we'll look at the trend of soldiers developing drug habits as a result of their service in Iraq. We'll bring you those stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh has quit as part of an agreement to establish a national unity government. Haniyeh came to power after Hamas swept the Palestinian elections a year ago. Since then, a Western aid embargo has wrecked the domestic economy, and infighting has destabilized internal security. Almost 100 Palestinians have died in the past 3 months due to factional fighting between Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has already agreed to reappoint Haniyeh to the position of prime minister in the National Unity Government. The British government suffered an embarrassing defeat in the British High Court today when it ruled that the decision to back the building of a new generation of nuclear power stations across the country was unlawful. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
The British government had promised the fullest public consultation before any decisions were made about controversial nuclear power. But the High Court judge said today that the consultation process was very seriously flawed and procedurally unfair. He agreed with Greenpeace, who brought the case, that information on the disposal of radioactive waste was not merely inadequate, but also misleading. The information given to consultees was wholly insufficient for them to make an intelligent response, and important information was only made public after the consultation period had ended. Greenpeace UK Director John Southern.
I think it's the arrogance of this government. You know, they make up their mind, and even when they say they're going to have a full public consultation, the exercise is just a sham. They just treat it with total disdain. They treat the public with total disdain.
The Minister in charge of energy policy, Alistair Darling, says the government will now hold another consultation process. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Madrid train bombing trial began today in Spain amid media frenzy and tight security. A total of 29 suspects are on trial. All have pleaded not guilty. The coordinated series of attacks on Madrid's rail network killed 191 people on March 11th of 2004. The proceedings are likely to last at least 5 months. A Mapuche community in Argentina's Patagonia region has won a legal dispute to keep sacred lands. Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
A court in Argentina has ruled against the eviction of a Mapuche indigenous family from lands in the southern province of Rio Negro. U.S. investor John Ogilvy claimed he had purchased the 5,000-acre tract 10 years ago and wanted the court to evict the Mapuche family living on the estate. A federal judge denied the request, ruling that Ogilvy could not own lands where communities have been living for over a century. In related news, Mapuche activists this week occupied lands claimed by the Italian-based Benetton Group in the Patagonian province of Chubut as part of an ongoing dispute over 2.2 million acres of Mapuche lands. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez yesterday threatened to nationalize grocery stores that do not adhere to strict price controls on basic food items, such as meat, milk, eggs, and other products. Greg Wilpert has the story from Caracas.
Chavez's latest announcement about possibly nationalizing grocery stores that break price controls comes amidst the meat shortage in Venezuela. Producers and distributors have been hoarding their supplies in resistance to price regulations. To address the shortage of meat and dairy products, the Chavez government had announced the elimination of the sales tax on such products and a slight increase in their price, so that producers would have an incentive to sell again. Chavez said that if retailers continue to manipulate the supply in order to drive up prices, his government would not hesitate to nationalize businesses found to be breaking the law. In the past week, the Venezuelan government reached amicable agreements to buy out investors who hold stock in Venezuela's main telecommunications company and its main electric company. The threat to nationalize food distributors will thus probably be taken very seriously by Venezuela's private sector. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas.
Conagra Foods has begun a recall of peanut butter packaged under the brand names Peter Pan and Great Value after a nationwide outbreak of salmonella. Consumers have been warned not to eat Great Value and Peter Pan brand peanut butters with the number 2111 printed on the lid. Federal officials say that nearly 300 people in 39 states have fallen ill with the foodborne disease since August. It is the first known instance of salmonella contamination of peanut butter. Conservationists fear that a fire aboard a Japanese whaling vessel could lead to an environmental disaster as the ship floats towards an important penguin breeding ground in Antarctica. The fire reportedly broke out in an area of the ship used to process whale carcasses. The damaged ship is carrying hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil. And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
On this third day of debate in the House of Representatives on troop increase to Iraq, anti-war groups are criticizing its substance, saying it doesn't go far enough. Lawmakers are already starting to look ahead to next steps, and as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, divisions within the party are likely.
Halfway through the third day of debate opposing the president's troop increase, more than 200 members of Congress have spoken, and many differing views have emerged. There are the Republicans who stand behind the president, Republicans who disapprove of the surge but will stand by their party, and then there are the Republicans who are siding with the Democrats. The Democratic Party is united behind their resolution, but divisions do exist. Those who want to cut funding and immediately end the war, and those who don't. Democratic leaders say they have not yet decided how to proceed on Iraq after this vote. But they're continuing to receive heavy pressure from the anti-war groups, many of which think the debate in the House is a waste of time.
This is not the time to talk about a problem with an escalation of a war that should never have happened. It's the time to end this war.
Nancy Lesson, co-founder of Military Family Speaks Out, is not the only anti-war activist who feels this way. Many of them do. Kevin Zeese is director of the anti-war group Democracy Rising. He was on Capitol Hill Thursday lobbying his Maryland representatives on the war.
Well, right now it's just a show, and I hope we see some real action.
The real action, they say, to cut funding. Democratic leadership has promised that this resolution opposing the troop surge is just the first step. But the real question is how much support anti-war groups will receive. Progressive Democrats were not given an optimal debate time. They're scheduled for Thursday night, one of the last groups scheduled to speak. Representative John Murtha, chair of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee and one of the most influential members regarding the war, won't support funding cuts. Instead, he promised that the next step will be to attack the troop increase through the $100 billion war supplemental. He plans to place conditions on the money that include an end to stop loss, no extended deployments for the military, equipment certification, and the closing of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib.
That stops the surge for all intents and purposes because, as I said over a year ago, they cannot sustain this deployment. And if you increase it, you just make it that much harder for them to sustain the deployment.
No squeeze ever goes far enough for some.
Representative Sam Farr, Democrat of California, addresses the difficulty of getting a majority of Congress to support the funding cuts.
Got 435 members back here, all with different opinions that come from their congressional districts. And for those of us from California and the Pacific Coast, I think we're much more progressive and about wanting to get out of Iraq now. But we're not the majority of the whole country, and we think the progress is being made. Not as fast as we'd like to make it, but it's being made.
Republicans are using funding cuts as a threat. Representative Sam Johnson, Republican of Texas and former prisoner of war.
He wants our men and women in uniform to think that their Congress doesn't care about them, that they're going to cut the funding and abandon them and their mission. They want Congress to cave to the wishes of those who advocate a cut-and-run attitude, and we should not allow that to happen.
But it could only be a matter of time before a majority of Congress does support funding cuts. New York Senator Charles Schumer inferred that a vote to cut the funds will happen, but at the end of a momentum-building process.
Because the president has veto power, and because we don't have 67 votes in the Senate or 290 votes in the House, there is not a magic bullet. And as Senator Kennedy constantly reminds us, he was here in the Vietnam days, this is a process where step by step by step, we ratchet up the pressure.
The Senate is still stuck on how to proceed on a debate on Iraq. Democrats threaten to work through the weekend and through their break next week if Republicans don't lift a hold on the debate. The House is expected to vote and pass their resolution tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As Congress continues its marathon debate on an increase of U.S. military forces in Iraq, President Bush called for a significant fund request to increase U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
I'm asking Congress for $11.8 billion over the next 2 years to help this young democracy survive. I've ordered an increase in U.S. forces in Afghanistan. We've extended the stay of 3,200 troops now in the country for 4 months, and we'll deploy a replacement force that will sustain this increase for the foreseeable future.
Bush delivered those comments in a speech today at the American Enterprise Institute. President Bush signed an executive order Wednesday to authorize the establishment of military commissions. With this order, cases against prisoners at Guantanamo Bay can be tried by military tribunals. FSRN's Nan McCurdy has more from Washington, D.C.
The executive order fulfills a technical step in the authorization of the establishment of military commissions under the Military Commissions Act of 2006, signed into law by Bush last October, and would allow for trials of Guantanamo detainees to begin. The act also denies access to U.S. courts to people accused of being foreign enemy combatants and removes their right to challenge their detention with a habeas corpus petition. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina was one of the primary authors of the Military Commissions Act.
We should have tried these people years ago, and I am confident the Supreme Court will uphold the Military Commission Act after the Hobden case. I predict on your show that the Supreme Court will uphold the Military Commissions Act, and the sooner we can get these people before a military tribunal, the better.
One of the first high-profile prisoners who may be tried is Australian David Hicks. Vice President Cheney's scheduled visit to Australia next week coincides both with the possibility of a trial for Hicks and the growing pressure in Australia on its conservative Prime Minister, John Howard, over the detention and treatment of Hicks. Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, says the tribunals outlined in the Military Commissions Act are unconstitutional and contrary to the Geneva Convention.
They are a throwback, really, to 50 years ago, before we had a real system of Geneva Convention justice as well as the current constitutional way of trying people. The Constitution and the conventions require that people be tried by tribunals that are in existence at the time of the alleged act. And the reason for that is you don't want the people making up the trials slanting the trials and the rules, slanting the rules so that they favor conviction. And of course, these trials do favor conviction at this point because the rules have been set so that they get conviction.
Earlier this week, Senate Democrats introduced legislation to restore habeas corpus rights to all detainees in U.S. custody. Attorneys have twice argued before the Supreme Court that Guantanamo detainees have a right to habeas corpus, and twice the Supreme Court has said they do. Both times, the Bush administration got the previous Republican-controlled Congress to say detainees do not have this right. The new bill, titled Restoring the Constitution Act of 2007, was introduced by Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. The bill could undercut the Military Commissions Act before constitutionality challenges to it reach the Supreme Court. If passed, the bill would override the Military Commissions Act because it would give detainees access to U.S. courts. Carolyn Fredrickson, director of the Legislative Office for the American Civil Liberties Union, says the Dodd bill would help to restore detainees' basic rights.
It takes away basic due process rights from people who our government is holding, allows our government to hold them forever, basically, without ever charging them, and removes the right of habeas corpus so that they have no way to bring a challenge to the courts about why they're being held or how they're being held.
Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania has been in favor of restoring the writ of habeas corpus for the nearly 400 people still held in detention on the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo.
I do know the problem at Guantanamo exists because the standards for detention are insufficient. And that's why I'm pressing so hard for habeas corpus.
Senator Specter went on to say he thinks the Dodd bill will pass and habeas corpus will be reinstituted by the Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
If George Bush goes ahead with his plans to send additional troops to Iraq, he'll do so with an army with many more soldiers with criminal records. Many of those recruits are guilty of drug crimes. At the same time, as Aaron Glantz reports, other soldiers are developing drug habits as a result of their service in Iraq.
Staff Sergeant Don Hanks served 15 years in the Army before he spent a year running patrols in the heart of Iraq's Sunni Triangle. He says he returned from the conflict a changed man.
I lost friends over there, and some of those friends I'd had for my whole freaking adult life. You know, and you're over at their houses, and you're barbecuing with their kids, and, you know, you get to know them and their families, and then just one day they're not there anymore because of something really bad. You know, It's just a really sad experience.
Hanks developed post-traumatic stress disorder, an anxiety disease that can emerge after exposure to a terrifying event or ordeal in which grave physical harm occurred or was threatened. A person experiencing PTSD can lose touch with reality and believe that the traumatic incident is happening all over again.
You start to forget. You know, can't tell you how many times I'd get up from my house and I'd walk into my kitchen or my bathroom or just forget why I was in the room. Just be standing there going, "Durr." You know, started to affect my interpersonal relationships. And when that happens, I bottled it up. And I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't go talk to somebody when I should have because of the stigma. Because I didn't want them to know that I was having problems. Because that is not the sign of a top performer. That is not the sign of a good soldier.
Hank says he became completely non-functional. He stopped going to the mall and other crowded places. He started smoking marijuana to cope with his mental problems. When he was hospitalized at a military mental institution, he failed a drug test. The military expelled Don Hanks, a move he did not fight because the alternative was another tour in Iraq.
We fought Saddam's regime, and we conquered it, and that's not it now. And you can feel it. You can see it. You can see it in your terps. You can see it in your the Iraqi forces that you're training. I don't know. I saw it as a senseless and tragic waste of life, to be honest.
Garrett Roppenhagen is chairman of the board of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He says Don Hanks' story is hardly unique.
A lot of the guys, they want to get out. And the military, you know, rather than taking it on the responsibility that the soldier has just fought in war and possibly damaged from that, and that's why they want to get out, they're just basically allowing these guys and almost helping these guys get these discharges just to get them out of the military and get rid of a problem.
The problem, says Roppenhagen, is that soldiers thrown out of the military for drug and alcohol abuse are often not eligible for veterans benefits because they've gotten a less than honorable discharge. That, he says, can have tragic effects.
In Colorado, there's a woman who, you know, I had Vets for Vets counseling sessions with named Jessica Rich, who just got tanked up and was speeding down the wrong side of the interstate the wrong way with no seatbelt on and slammed head-on against a Suburban and killed her instantly. So these things are happening, and there's not a lot being done to treat these soldiers, so it's common.
In the meantime, resistance to war from the inside of the military continues to grow. More than 1,000 active duty soldiers have signed a petition calling for an immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. Former Staff Sergeant Don Hanks says he knows 4 soldiers from Fort Lewis who have gone AWOL rather than returning for a second deployment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
Bail was reduced in a San Francisco Superior Courtroom yesterday for 8 former community activists, some of whom were Black Panthers, from $5 or $6 million to $3 million. The 8 were arrested last month and charged with the murder of a San Francisco police officer in 1971. The They were recently indicted on the same evidence that was ruled inadmissible in 1974 because it was extracted by police torture. And although the new trial is set in San Francisco, critics cite that the FBI's counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, is directly involved in their case as part of a larger operation to destroy the Black Liberation Movement. We're joined on the line by Lawrence Reyes. He's a member of the Jericho Amnesty Coalition Los Angeles, which helped to organize a rally in support of the Panther Eight. Lawrence, four of the eight were in a San Francisco courtroom yesterday. Can you describe what happened there?
There was a significant showing of support. Family, friends of the four of the San Francisco Eight packed the San Francisco courthouse of Judge Little. Many people were unable to get in. As the four, Ray, Richard, Hank, and the other Richard were brought into the courtroom in shackles, supporters burst into applause. The large showing of sheriffs and squad officers cleared the courtroom. People gathering in the hallway outside, Department 12 chanting "No justice, no peace." Defense attorneys objected to closing the public hearing, and the judge agreed to let the people back into court as long as they were not making too much noise. But only after each individual was again searched and put through metal detectors, shoes taken off, and the such. So that's what happened yesterday. We held a rally here because, you know, these are trumped-up charges. Similar charges were completely thrown out of court as a result of the torture that these brothers went through in New Orleans in 1973. The judge dismissed the charges. And, you know, what we're calling for is an immediate release, no bail or reasonable bail, because these men are not a threat to the community and are not a security threat as well.
Now, we've heard a lot about possible federal involvement in this case. Can you talk about that?
Sure. When the Attorney General was sworn in, he promised, he made an unequivocal promise that he will do anything necessary to round up every Black Panther that was still in the United States. So we feel that this is another attempt to reinstall COINTELPRO, the FBI secret legal counterintelligence program, which targeted the Black Panther Party and other Black freedom organizations, as well as the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords Party, the Brown Berets, and the Young Patriots. We know that this attack is a direct attempt by the federal government to continue to hold the political prisoners who are currently incarcerated and those who declare themselves as prisoners of war. This latest attempt follows closely the recent charges that were filed against the cold-blooded KKK murderers whose cases have recently been activated. It is a blatant, politically motivated attempt to intimidate and derail the call for new congressional hearings into COINTELPRO, the actual police FBI conspiracy to kill Panthers.
And finally, can you explain the significance of removing these elders, if you will, from their communities to try them now for a crime that allegedly happened in 1971?
Sure. I mean, you have one of the elders, Richard Brown, is for the past 6 years has been a community court judge, an arbitrator working in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office. You know, Ray Boudreau is an electrician. Hank Jones works with youth in the community. So extracting these brothers out of the community, these elders, you know, is a direct affront of taking the leadership out of the African-American community and the Black community, where these men are, you know, assets to their communities, and not to mention ripping them away from their family, their grandchildren, and the such.
We've been speaking with Lawrence Reyes with the Jericho Amnesty Coalition Los Angeles about the case of the Panther Eight. And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
How black is our History Month? For years, decades now, folks have celebrated Black History Month with a plethora of events. There will be movies, book readings, poetry, concerts, and the like. Coming as it does on the heels of the nation's celebration of the life of Martin Luther King Jr., much of what will be heard will no doubt echo that event. But Black history is far richer and far deeper than King. Reverend Dr. King, who has been edited into a safe, sweet, nonviolent, modern-day Christ-like figure and icon of peace, forgiveness, and forbearance, has himself been transformed into a one-dimensional figure which ignores his fullness as a growing, thinking, developing man. He was far more radical than many of those who now call his name are ready to admit. There will be little, if any, remembrance of the men and women who fought for freedom in far more aggressive and militant ways. While some may hear the occasional names, usually they too are softened and sweetened with time to make them safe historical morsels for white corporate consumption. It's doubtful that the name William Parker will be shouted out, even though over a century and a half ago he led the Christiana Revolt in Pennsylvania, which because of its nature sent shockwaves across the country, so much so that historians of the era, like James McPherson and Philip Foner, considered Christiana to be harbingers of the Civil War to come. Parker, his wife Eliza, and other members of the Special Secret Committee, a black self-defense group, fought against slave owners and U.S. Marshals who wanted to send people back into slavery. The Parkers and their neighbors fought with guns, machetes, and sticks. Parker and his clan of freedom fighters had to flee the U.S. to find freedom. The Christiana Revolt of 1851 should be on millions of lips during Black History Month, but there will be no movies, no special notices in the corporate press, and few scattered references to this signal event in the history of the struggle for freedom. And while we may know the name of the famous rebel, Nat Turner, how many of us actually celebrate his memory? His fight for freedom echoed around the world, for it showed that the violence of slavery would be answered by the violence of the oppressed. For what was slavery but violence, and resistance against that violence but self-defense? I doubt that the name Charles Delon will elicit the least flicker of recognition, but he was the leader of a slave revolt that rocked New Orleans in 1811. The revolt aboard the Amistad is known to many, due in part to movies. But the Amistad wasn't the only one. Ships like Little George were seized over a century before the Amistad. But today, who knows its name? Here, in 1730, some 96 captives seized the craft and in 9 days successfully sailed back to Africa. 2 years thereafter, Africans aboard the William did the same thing, set the crew adrift, and sailed back home. The late, great Herbert Apfecker, in his classic American Negro Slave Revolts, recounted over 250 such rebellions against the vile slave system. Coming closer to our time, how many of us will look back, not centuries, but mere months, to the horrors and hypocrisies of Hurricane Katrina? For black history didn't end centuries ago, and didn't begin with the Civil Rights Act. It's an ancient history, and also as present as yesterday. Katrina, the ravages not of weather, but of government, as black arts movement poet, playwright, and essayist Marvin X put it eloquently in his recent Beyond Religion Towards Spirituality, we have tried their sham democratic elections to no avail, as we saw in the 2000 general election, when our votes were discounted. Between our treatment in the 2000 election and Katrina, what else do we need to know about American democracy? Well, part of no, don't you understand? Both events revealed America to be nothing more than a banana republic with respect to us. We were treated worse than dogs in both respects. Black History Month, a time to remember that which the corporate culture wishes is forgotten. A time to remember rebellion, resistance, and what it means to be black in the white nation today. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Tina Gacy and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team is at KPFA in Berkeley and includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.